Welcome to the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast, where we take information from the highest level of sport and make it accessible for all cyclists. I'm your host, Zach Morris, and in this episode, I'm sitting down with who might be the most important person in the whole EF Pro Cycling organization, the CEO himself, Mr. Jonathan Botters. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I don't know if I'm the most important person, but that's typically reserved for the people actually pedaling the bikes. But hey, anyway.
Yeah, but somebody has to give those people pedaling the bikes direction.
Yeah.
It's got to count for something.
Yeah. I give them all kinds of bad advice.
Some good advice too, I'm sure. Hey, so this year is obviously, we'll get into the camp and the coaching stuff after the first part of the podcast, but as you saw from our guests that actually attended the pro camp here in Girona, and for those that don't know, we're here right now in Girona at the official team camp. And before the team camp, we had our coaching camp where we brought a group of individuals from all over the world to do a week of riding in Girona, Spain on the same roads, eat with the pros, be a part of the pro team camp for a couple of days, go for a ride with them at the end. And that was really cool. And you were a part of that. And they were all so curious about the team this year. And I think most of our listeners are really excited about the team this year. We're looking at, you know, a bunch of new riders, some really big name riders. So I want to ask you, how do you feel about the team?
Well, I mean, it's a roster composition that has obviously really big potential. You know, but you've got to always execute on that potential, which is the tricky part. But I mean, if you're going to look at it on paper, you know, it's a roster that has huge upside, especially, you know, in anything that's hilly, you know, any sort of stage race, you know, across the board. I mean, even, you know, hilly classics, to a degree, the cobbled classics. The only thing where, I mean, you know, our weak spot is obviously sprinting at this point in time, but you know, you have to pick your battles, and that's just not a battle that we've chosen to pick at this point in the team's history.
So what were you looking to accomplish this year when you were building out the team?
Well, over the years, it's become, I think, you know, you have to step back a little bit as cycling, as professional world tour cycling has gotten exponentially more expensive. You have to step back and look at, you know, what sort of commercial value you're giving to your sponsors, which is, you know, still the lifeblood of the business model of the sport. And with that said, you know, those sponsors are looking at how to kind of hit a broad audience and how to have their name associated as simply as possible with a team that is competitive, you know, at the highest level, right? So with all that being said, fundamentally, the easiest thing for your average fan or your casual fan of cycling to understand is racing for the overall in the Tour de France, right? Now, that's also the most expensive roster that you can, you know, when you try to build a roster to try to do well in the overall general classification of the Tour de France, that's as expensive as it gets, right? But that is where the fundamental value is. So we have to look at it, roster building, and I'm sorry that I kind of pull it back into like this commercial, like saying, well, we have to look at it from a commercial aspect, but let's be realistic, we do. We're not like a regional team. And when I say a regional team, let's you know, in a way, like Quickstep or Soudal, Intermarché, even Jumbo Visma is a regional team,
right?
Regional sponsor. You know, Jumbo supermarkets don't exist in, you know, in Connecticut. It's a regional sponsor, not a global sponsor. And they have their demands as far as what they produce are very much based on a regional market. Well, in Belgium and Holland, even to a degree in France, people are avid cycling fans. They follow every single race, okay? So how they do in the Brabantsappel, Brabantsappel, how they do in that race is really important. to Jumbo, to Quickstep, to Intermarché. When you're dealing with a global company that is looking at like bike riding as sort of their first platform, like healthy bike riding worldwide, and then okay, and then we want to have this professional cycling team that really throws out our brand image around the world in a positive way, and we're going to have them race in the Tour de France. And all the other races, you know, are less important and to a degree to a global sponsor like that. So you really have to look at how do you build a team to perform in the Tour de France. If you're looking at a global team, or even in, when I say global team, let's call it, we're an American registered team, but that's basically the same thing as a global team, because the regional interest in the US is not as high as it is in Belgium. So we have to basically really focus our roster on performing well in the Tour de France, because that is the bread and butter of what a global cycling team or a global sponsor involved with a cycling team is after, and everything else kind of falls after that.
Fascinating. So we were on the ride the other day with Rigo and Carapaz, right? We noticed a little bit of half feeling going on.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
What do you think about that matchup?
Well, you know, interestingly, I think that Rigo understands, you know, that his role is going to be to help Carapaz in the Tour de France. But that being said, I think Rigo really feels like this is his team. And okay, welcome aboard, new kid, but you're still the new kid. And from what I can see just in the you know, first couple of days of camp, that Rigo really wants to, he wants to perform next year in a way that I haven't seen in a little while. Like he really wants to perform next year, because he wants to make sure people still know that this is his team. And he'll be, you know, helping out Carapaz in the Tour de France, but damned if he's not going to be like the guy that when he makes his last pull, you know, on the last climb, that like it actually makes Carapaz hurt a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about Education First in the Tour de France, you think about Rigo.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I mean, you know, since he was second place in 2017, he's always been, you know, the anchor point of what we've done in the Tour de France. You know, and he still will be in some ways, but he knows that he's probably past the point that he can podium in the Tour de France. And so he's gonna be the don of the team and kind of govern the team and show them the way.
So I got to ask you the big question. If all the stars were to align, do you think Carapaz is good enough to win the Tour de France?
Well, I mean, you got to have a lot of stars align on that one. In sort of straight up drag racing up the final climbs, you know, of whatever stage in the Tour de France, there's quite a few mountaintop finishes. So, you know, watts per kilogram, ergometer test, you know, is he the match of Pogacar or Vingegaard? And so far, our data points on that are a little bit limited. We can only look in the Tour de France, because you know, when you get into the Giro and this and that, it's a different thing. But in the Tour de France, we can only sort of look to what he did in 2021, right? In 2021, in the last 10 days of the Tour de France, he was able to equal those two guys. In the first 10 days of the Tour de France, he was not. So, you know, end of the day, it's a little hard to say. What I do know is that we were, you know, when you say the stars align, the first star that aligned is that we were given a Tour de France that basically has one fairly short time trial that's mainly uphill. So that helped us a lot right out of the pipe. And that helped his ambitions quite a bit. But you know, this isn't, you know, he's certainly not going to go into the race as the race favorite. Certainly not going to, you know, be written about in all the publications in the run up to the Tour de France. I mean, it's going to be the big battle, you know, Pogacar versus Vingegaard. I mean, that's fine. I mean, I feel like we're happy to stay out of the headlines, stay off everyone's radar, and just quietly go about our work, and then we'll see what he can do. And it might be something spectacular, and it, you know, and it might not. But to be fair to him, he's never gone into the Tour de France with the ambition of, you know, trying to win the thing. And he's never gone into the Tour de France with a team that was solely behind that ambition. And he's never gone into the Tour de France, you know, in 2021 when he was third, you know, there's a 40K flat time trial in Bordeaux. So everything's new. And we'll see where that leads to. I mean, you know, he might end up eighth, or you know, he might end up actually like he was in the Vuelta, where he kind of cracks early on and ends up chasing stage wins, and maybe we try to get the King of the Mountain jersey. I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities. So it's hard to say, sitting here looking at a Christmas tree in the month of December, you know, yes, he can challenge for the Tour. No, he can't. I don't have the answer to that just yet.
Talk to me about how you feel about some of the, you know, maybe underrated stars on the team who would be taking on that dedicated support role. I mean, when we look at guys like Nielsen Paulus, Magnus Cort, obviously Rigo, and then we've got a new guy named Andre Amador, who's got quite a lot of experience, Hunro. We've got some big engines on the team this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's a team with a lot of ambitious riders, but interestingly, in all the rider meetings we've had, when we talk about the Tour de France, they're all excited to try to help a guy who's got a shot. There haven't been any, well, I'd rather do the Giro because, you know, I know in the Tour I'm not going to have my own opportunity. Da, 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 da. I haven't heard that in a single rider meeting. Every single rider meeting I've heard is absolutely on board with, you know, and I want to make the Tour team, even though I know I'm a foot soldier. So that's a new, you know, that's a new thing. I think, you know, Carapaz also is a guy who he likes to hit his objectives, and he doesn't get too concerned with a lot of the other races. So that leaves a lot of room for other ambition, as to say, you know, I don't know, in Liège-Bastogne-Liège or the Volta Catalunya or I don't know, whatever race it is, there's a lot of room for other people that have ambition, because Carapaz historically is a guy who's, you know, who said, I want to win this race, and then he builds toward that race, and either, you know, he wins or he comes pretty close. You know, Olympic Games, Giro d'Italia, whatever it is, like he nails it. But if you look at his run up races to, you know, like the Giro that he won in Waterhouse, there's nothing really that spectacular there. There's plenty of room for other people that want to try to win.
Fascinating to see. I mean, I kind of see it from a little bit further away, as the stars really aligning, right? I think we've got some incredible engines on the team this year. And I think everybody being excited to ride and support really speaks a lot to the culture of EF and how that actually extends down to the team, right? It's a great company, and the energy around everybody here at the team is, I think it's really rare in pro cycling. And you got a great group of people on both ends, on the, you know, management side of the team, on the marketing side, and then in the riders. I mean, you can sit down and talk to any of these guys, and they're all normal, regular people.
Yeah, I mean, we've always had the attitude that we don't really want this sort of hyper arrogant superstar on the team, because that actually detracts from the team. I mean, again, going back to the commercial proposition of any cycling team, is that if the brand of the team becomes about one rider, and, you know, you've seen this happen with Peter Sagan and in the past, and I don't know, you know, maybe it's about to start happening with like a Evenepoel on Quickstep, is that the brand of the team becomes tied up in one rider, and it's all about sort of that person or there. That actually isn't good for a sponsor. No matter how many races that person wins, when it becomes more about the individual and less about the team, the people that are the financial backers actually get pushed off into the shadows, because it's not Team EF who wins the race. It's, you know, this person, it's whatever, Peter Sagan or that person, whatever. And cycling fans, you know, of course they tend to gravitate toward individual personalities, right? But as much as I understand that from an emotional standpoint, that you want to attach yourself to the personality that you really like, that's hard for sponsors to look at, because they want the name of the team, the spirit of the team, the brand of the team, to be the first and foremost thing. They want people to be fans of the team, not to be fans of the individual. So when we recruit, and that goes for staff or riders, we recruit for people that are, you know, that are willing to let the brand of the team sort of be the first thing, and that they will always be sort of second. And you know, not everyone likes that, and I'm sure there's quite a few riders in the World Tour that realize that they would always be second to the brand of the overall team, and so they don't want to come and race for us. But the guys that do like that, and do want to be a part of that, tend to be, you know, the crew that we have, which I would say the crew that we have are an incredibly intelligent, warm, you know, just generally good people. And that's across the board. And I think that's rare. Let's not just say in professional cycling, in professional sports. I think that's rare, having a group that are just like good people.
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, at our camp this week, we had pretty much all really high-level individuals, CEOs of their companies, people who have built things. And people skills they go a long way, not only with, you know, CEOs and the big bosses of the world, but, you know, when you're dealing with all different types of people. And what was so amazing for all of our guests this week was how appreciative they were of feeling accepted amongst the people who they see as stars. Even if it's the mechanic that works for the team, for these people, that is so cool to meet that person who's, you know, battled all these different battles and experienced things like going to the Tour de France and being a part of it. Those stories, sharing those stories with them, just meant so much. So yeah, congratulations to you and everybody else from EF who's really, you know, worked hard to build that culture, because it's a special thing.
Yeah, I mean, thank you very much. It's a fun team to be a part of, and it's a nice culture. I mean, ultimately, you know, that's, I mean, EF, the core value, or well, one of the core values of EF is, you know, is expanding the world and expanding understanding of the world through education. And, you know, I think we take that on board on the cycling team, is that basically, you know, we're here to, you know, we're here to promote an education company. It's not a Petro Nation.
Yeah.
So we have to be, you know, respectful of the world and the different cultures of the world. And I know that starts to get a little bit sappy, like, oh, we're going to be respectful of, you know, different cultures of the world, and da, 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 da. But that doesn't mean you can't win bike races. That just means, like, hey, why don't we also, like, be good people in the interim of winning bike races? We don't have to be jerks.
Yeah. So let's transition a little bit back to when you and I first started to build out the coaching business, early days. Mm. We had this idea. We're like, let's build a coaching business that can bridge the gap to sport, create more fans for the cycling team. This was the first time that you've, you know, kind of been around the business in person at a camp, met the customers.
No.
How did you feel about it?
No, I mean, I think it's great. I mean, EF coaching, to me, the first and foremost principle of it was, you know, as a team, what, you know, when we did back in 2017, when the team was about to go belly up, right? And we did our, you know, Indiegogo fundraiser campaign, Save Argyle, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we raised over $1 million doing that. And what did we give people in return for that $1 million that they gave to us? Well, we gave them a cycling team. Okay. So we did save the team. And then we sent out a bunch of mugs and t-shirts, and that's what they got. Now, I know a lot of you that have did the Save Argyle thing. Thank you very much. And I know that you all love your coffee mugs because you send me pictures of them on Twitter all the time. And thank you for doing that. But EF coaching is actually giving the fans the most valuable asset the team actually has. Because if you think about it a little, like, what assets does a cycling team have? Well, we've got buses and bikes and, you know, we've got people under contract for a short period of time. But the most valuable asset that a cycling team owns is the knowledge of how to make a world tour cycling team work and how to make an athlete ride fast. That's the most valuable asset that any of us that work, you know, in the performance side of EF Pro Cycling have. And so we thought, well, so what do our fans want? You know, if you think about, like, what does a football fan want? Well, a football fan wants to sit in front of their TV and watch one really fast, strong guy smash into another really fast, strong guy. Okay. Bike racing fans tend to ride bikes themselves. And so they really appreciate watching a guy ride their bike really fast. But a little bit like downhill skiing or running, they also want to ride their bike fast. So the thing they would be most appreciative of is to learn a little bit how they can ride their bike faster. That's you know, I think the endurance athletics just tend to attract people that are not only fans of the sport, but they're participants in the sport. They want to do it themselves. And that's very different from any other professional sport. And so EF coaching was invented on the principle of, well, this is the most valuable thing we have to give our fans. So let's start doing that.
And everybody that came to the camp this week had been on other bike trips with coaches. Many of them have worked with coaches in the past. Some of them, of course, were our clients. But not a single person said that they had ever experienced something like they experienced this week. Every day was packed with a pre-ride briefing, you know, nutrition protocols, clear objectives that we were going to go out and tackle on each day, each stage, whatever you want to call it. Came back home, attended a seminar on things like hip mobility, upper cross syndrome, nutrition, right? And so we really extended or did our best to extend the education side of it. And everybody said they had no idea that that's what they were signing up for, but that it was the best experience that they had ever had because they felt like they had left and truly learned something about cycling. And it came really clear to me that while there are a lot of other coaches out there in the world, and I'm sure a lot of them do a great job, not many can really extend this educational part of it where you go to a camp like this and you leave a week later a completely different rider that not only sees the way you do your activity that you like, but sees the entire sport through a different lens.
Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the fun parts about that is that the more you educate people on, you know, how complex it is to actually ride a bike faster and how many factors are involved in that, the more they start to actually respect the professional side of the sport. You know, they not only start to learn how to make themselves go faster, but they start to realize, wow, these pro guys are, like, they're putting a lot together. Like, they have a lot on their plate, and they're making it work. And I think, again, it's almost like I think most coaches tend to sort of want to just tell their athletes what to do, and the athlete does it, and then, you know, hopefully the output of that is a good result at some point in time. But the athlete ultimately doesn't know why the good result happened. The coach might. I think what we're doing here, EDF coaching, is that we're actually teaching people why the inputs work, why the methods work, why the pros use those same inputs and methods, and why it works for them. And, you know, that only, like I said, not only makes them faster, better, more knowledgeable, but that knowledge that they learn makes them respect the sport of cycling so much more. And then you start getting really knowledgeable fans of professional cycling, which ultimately is what will drive the sport of cycling. Because we sort of all know, those of us who've been behind the scenes of the sport for a number of years, that, man, if people could understand how this really works, they would just fall in love with this sport, right?
Yeah.
But they're not going to understand that. Just, you know, watching it on TV and listening, you know, to Bob Roll talk about bike racing, they're not going to learn really what's going on and the intricacies behind the teams. And a lot of times I talk about the business model because people don't, they have no idea how crazy intricate the business model is and how that we're, you know, constructing these commercial platforms that have to work just perfectly. And if they don't, the whole thing falls apart. Da, da, da. I have no idea. It's the same thing with how you construct a training model, that it's incredibly complex. And so when they learn that and then they do it, they go out on the road and they do it, and then they see how well, you know, the pro riders do it, it just, it opens up a whole new universe to them. And then when they watch the race, they can say, oh, now I see, okay, now when I see this guy attacks on an uphill, I see how he's, you know, placing his body weight over the pedals, you know, as opposed to pushing on the pedals, that he's using his body weight to propel the bike forward as opposed to just muscular force. And man, is he doing that in a beautiful way. And holy shit, he's going fast. And, you know, when I try to go do that, I do my very best. I don't quite execute it as well as I do, but at least I understand what he's doing. And they watch it, and all of a sudden now they start to see the beauty of the whole thing. And then now they're deep fans. They're not just fans. They're deep fans of the sport.
Well, what was fascinating was that we had people on this camp that have been riding their bikes for 30 years, right? And every single person at the camp learned how to stand properly for the first time on their bike.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
Yeah. I mean, of course, again, I mean, that's the way. Yeah. I don't know if this sounds a little haughty, but that's the way when I go out on, you know, when I go out and ride my bike and doodle around with people and occasionally maybe go do a group ride or something, you know, whether someone's fit or not, you can always spot an ex-pro. You can, you know, they might be out of shape and they might not be going that fast, but you can spot an ex-pro from a mile off. And people are, well, how can you do that? And it's, you know, it's how they pedal. But the biggest thing is when they get up out of the saddle, you can see it. In a New York second, you go, that guy used to race pro, or that woman used to race pro, because the way they move the bike underneath them is entirely different than someone who didn't. And it's you know, it's fascinating. Like there could be people that are a ton stronger than this ex-professional rider. Most of the time there are, because, you know, us ex-pros tend to get a little lazy. But you can see that immediately. And so to actually teach people how to make progress in that efficiency of out of the saddle riding, I mean, it seems like a silly thing, but it's, you know, the teaching them how to do that, and you can visibly see the improvement. That's pretty neat.
Well, when you're only sitting, it's like trying to build a house with just a hammer, no saw, no right. Nail gun, right? No cadence range development, no body position development. And the reality is, like, if you don't train standing, if you never get out of the saddle, chances are it's going to be pretty hard when you first start doing it, because you don't have all of those muscles firing.
No.
Properly
no,
to
no.
be able to do it efficiently.
Yeah.
What was pretty cool was we had one rider here before we did any of the standing technique drills. We did a baseline fitness test, and that guy went out and he was really fit. He did 380 watts for his 5 minute effort, right? At the end of the camp with fatigue, right? And we'll say decent standing technique.
Yeah.
He was able to take that power from 380 to 405,
right,
which is a massive jump. Like for a pro rider,
right,
what would 25 watts? Yeah, be 20, on
you
minute?
Don't get 25 watt improvements very often as a pro rider. Don't, no, yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, and then probably a lot of that is due to the fact that he could efficiently alternate. You know, that basically, you know, he could sit for a little while and then just do like 10 or 15 seconds out of the saddle to just alleviate the muscles that you use in the saddle, and then go back, sit down, and then fatigue out those muscles, and then just give them a 15-second break out of the saddle. And, you know, in climbing, that, I mean, of course, out of the saddle climbing, you use in a very high power, high torque situation, i.e. attacking, you know, sprinting, catching a wheel, whatever it is. But it's also used in a steady state effort climbing to just change up the muscle groups a little bit so that you don't over fatigue a particular muscle group, right? So probably he's getting that 25 watts out of the fact that he was able to sort of distribute the power in more muscle groups than he was just by sitting and doing the whole thing, you know, sat down.
That's so I'm more of the on the sprinter heavier side, as you know, right? And I live in Colombia. Those guys go uphill really fast, yeah. Right? So the only way I'm even able to play bikes with my friends is to be super efficient, right? I'm not 58 kilos, you know, just floating up the climbs like they are, you know? And so I use standing primarily to rest.
Yeah.
Because I can drop all my heavy body weight into the pedal stroke, lower my RPM, transition to slightly more muscular system dominance, and bring my heart rate down.
Right.
And I wonder, you know, how many guys, even in pro cycling, are aware of these different options that they have, selecting cadence and body position. What do you think?
You know, I don't know how many would be intellectually aware of that, but they're intuitionally aware of it, meaning that just over so many years of racing and being in situations where you're having to optimize just to hold the wheel in front of you, that they've learned that intuitively, instinctively. Whether or not they know why they're doing what they're doing, well, it's a different question. But they're doing it out of, you know, sort of Darwinian adaptation.
So we had Kevin Sprouse on the podcast, and he really emphasized the importance of strength training. And, you know, we've had several podcasts now discussing kind of the evolution of riders. We're starting to see a more muscular rider. I mean, in your era, I still think everybody was pretty thin. And then we had the, you know, like Contador and the Froome era where they were really, really skinny. And now we're seeing, like, you know, Pogačar, Remco, Wout, these guys getting a little bit bigger, doing more watts. What's your take on this new generation of rider type?
Well, I mean, ultimately, you know, to win the Tour de France or any of the grand tours, it's still going to come down to watts per kilogram. But you are correct in saying that Pogačar, you know, is Evenepoel as well. They are more muscular riders than sort of, you know, Froome as an example. So, you know, I don't know. I couldn't really tell you exactly why that is. And it's hard to say. I mean, I think that I don't know that the necessarily the sport's going through, you know, an evolution there, because like I said, ultimately it does come down to watts per kilogram. And there's, you know, there's two ways you can improve that equation. It's the numerator or the denominator, one or the other, reduce the kilograms, increase the watts. But it is interesting to see that. You know, I think the racing has become more aggressive on the flat parts of the race, faster from the start. You know, races tended to just be ridden more aggressively right out of the gun than they were 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even definitely 20 years ago. So, you know, perhaps it has something to do with the fact that, you know, a slightly larger, more muscular rider is able to actually tolerate the number of accelerations and the high speeds and the flats before they even get to the mountains. So they're actually coming to the mountainous stages of the Tour de France, or even the mountains at the end of a stage, they're coming into that fresher. Then, you know, a guy like Froome, for instance, really struggled with accelerations on the flats, generally not the most aerodynamic rider, sort of, you know, had a lanky, gangly position on the bike and elbows out and whatever else, probably wasn't super aerodynamic, and was really relying on sort of minimal body weight to get him up those hills, right? So if the race is super aggressive on flat roads, that's going to be harder for him than it is, you know, Pogačar, who would just be perfectly natural and fine no matter how fast the race is going on the flat. So So then you get to the final climb of that day, or you get to the climbing when you hit stage 10 after you've been beat up for 10 days on flat roads. And in either of those scenarios, he's just going to be fresher compared to, you know, a guy who's lighter and less aerodynamic isn't going to be as fresh.
So the reason why I asked that question is because I think for a lot of our athletes in the coaching side, really maximizing the watts per kilo side of things might be a challenge. You know, a lot of our athletes are riding 8 to 15 hours a week, tops, I'd say on the top end. Mm. We don't have many riders. We do have some, but we don't have, the bulk of it is not the people doing 24 hours, 25 hours a week on their bike, right? So really reaching that ultimate composition of watts per kilo, it isn't really in reach forever, right? So what they are able to do, though, is even though they might be slightly heavier, but have some time to like go to the gym, get more muscular strength, they can take that and apply it to the road and actually still climb pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when muscular strength at its base, I mean, your strength training, when you really apply it to an endurance sport, the first and key concept to understand, and this is getting a little bit techy here, but is that when each time your muscle contracts in a pedal stroke, right? So, you know, your quadriceps and your glutes contracting on the downstroke of a pedal stroke, right? There is a point at which the muscle is contracting at such a high percentage of its maximum force that it can exert that your vascular system collapses. So the muscle is contracting so hard that all the arteries and veins in the muscle basically are smashed down so small that they're no longer able to feed oxygen for just a second. You know, you get now into the upstroke, the quadricep relaxes and okay, you get an oxygen feed again. But for a split second, you're basically reducing the oxygen delivery to your muscles over and over again. So now there are two ways you can prevent that from happening. One is you ride a higher RPM when you're at that higher power output, and that reduces the amount of force on the muscle because you're using a smaller gear. Okay, and then that can keep the oxygen delivery up. But at a higher RPM, you're moving your legs a lot more, and that means a higher consumption of oxygen. There's just more movement. So you're going to use more oxygen. You're going to reach your maximum heart rate. You're going to reach your lactate threshold more quickly. The other way is that you increase the maximum force that your muscle can exert on the pedal. So that point at which the vascular system collapses is actually at a higher torque on the pedal stroke, right? So strength training, and the reason that we see a lot of studies with strength training actually increasing lactate threshold, which makes no logical sense. Like why would, you know, sitting on a leg press machine or doing squats, why would that increase your lactate threshold, which is this sort of power up, but that you can produce for half an hour or 45 minutes? Kind of makes no sense because, you know, you're on the leg press for 45 seconds. Nobody actually knows the true answer as to why that happens, but it does happen. But one of the best theories out there is that essentially you're increasing the maximum force that the muscle can apply to a surface, i.e. pedals. And by doing that, the vascular system is not collapsing until it's at a much higher power output, meaning that your oxygen delivery, you're able to deliver oxygen up to a higher power output, even at a relatively lower RPM. And therefore, you're able to increase your lactate threshold.
So do you think, I mean, I've asked this question to almost everybody that's been on the podcast. Do you think that now that the vast majority of high-level pros are strength training almost all year, this is having an impact on the way we're racing bikes?
Oh, I mean, for sure. I mean, especially on shorter climbs, you can see that in races like Tour of Flanders or Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Obviously in sprinting, yes. I mean, but that should be a given, is that in sprinting, yeah, you know, like more muscle mass, you know, ability to produce higher torque is going to, but even in races like Tour of Flanders, I think if we're looking at how the top level riders are able to produce torque over those, you know, shorter 2 to 4 minute climbs, For sure, the fact that strength training has become more prevalent is changing the way the sport looks and feels, and the speed at which they're able to go over their shorter climbs.
So one of the questions I have to ask you, what do you think makes a great cyclist in 2022?
Oh boy. I mean, it's the same things that have always made a great cyclist. It's just the parameters change a little bit from era to era. But I mean, a great cyclist is, you know, it's a combination. What I was used to say is it's a combination of a marathon runner and a Formula One car driver, right? And that still applies. It's a reasonable, easy analogy in that you've got, you know, a great endurance athlete that can produce energy from a massive amount of oxygen that they can turn over in their body. Got to have that. Okay, so that's a great marathon runner. But I would say, you know, 99% of marathon runners out there, probably hand-eye coordination, balance, being able, situational awareness, those aren't going to be their strong points, right? Whereas a cyclist has to be able to rail around a corner at, you know, 70-80 k an hour. A cyclist has to be able to ride centimeters off the wheel in front of them. A cyclist has to have the situational awareness of 100 and some odd riders immediately around them at all times, and, you know, how that works, right? So you're dealing with this combination of somebody that has incredible balance, hand-eye coordination skills, along with somebody that can shift massive amounts of oxygen, right? And those are totally different things. And I mean, it's like they're, you know, one is like almost like a video game, and the other one is just this pure, you know, endurance suffering part. But a bike racer has to be both. Then on top of that, because that's too simple, which is crazy that's already too simple. On top of that, a bike racer also has to have an enormous glycolytic capacity. So their glycolytic capacity, you know, meaning everything from a 20-second, you know, effort, maximum power all the way to, you know, say 5 minutes. So a bike racer also has to be, you know, boiling it down to running equivalents, a great 400-meter runner and a great 800-meter runner. Because if you don't have that, if you're just the marathon runner and you can't accelerate, sorry, but you're not, you might finish some bike races at the top level, but you're never going to win one. So in order to win, you know, 6-hour bike races, 7-hour bike races are won typically, when we boil it down in our power files, they're won in like 3 or 4 4 to 5 minute segments. That's what the race is won and lost. So essentially, you know, Tour Flanders or Liège-Bastogne-Liège, you look at, there's sort of the first selection is made by a 4 minute bam, you know, at kilometer 180 or thereabouts. That sort of divides your top 50th percentile and the lower 50th percentile. Boom, that's done. Okay. Then the next one, that cuts it down from, that goes 50-50 again. And then the next one goes 50-50 again. And then finally you're down to, you know, 3 or 4 guys disputing the actual race win. But it's almost like, you'd be better off doing 4 or 5 minute intervals to win Liège-Bastogne-Liège than you would be riding 6-hour rides. So let's just go out doing a 1-hour ride and do 4 by 5 minute intervals, and then we're going to win Liège-Bastogne-Liège. That won't work because, again, as I say, this is an infinitely complex sport. You have to have it all. You have to have, there's no other sport like this. You have to have massive glycolytic capacity like these power sports have, like sprinting on track and field, or like American football, or, you know, even European football. You've got massive glycolytic capacity, right? You've got to have that. You've got to have the Formula One car driving skills. You also have to have the endurance to do a 6-hour, 7-hour, you know, almost like ultra marathon skills, right? And you got to pull that all together into one athlete. So your answer to your question is that it's cyclists at the highest level are the most complex athlete, like metabolically speaking, physiologically speaking, they're the most complex athletes on the world because they have to do all these things. Like triathletes only have to do one thing, steady, 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 steady. I mean, 3 different sports, but it's steady, 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 steady. 800 meters on the track, that's pure glycolytic power, right? 100 meter sprinters on the track, that's just pure ATP. That's pure muscular strength and speed. You know, all of these sports they've got their one specialty area. Cyclists, you got to do all of it. You have to do all of it, and you have to be a great driver or you're going to end up in a ditch with a broken collarbone and you're never going to be very good then.
Well, I think what maybe bike racers may or may not be aware of is that by going and doing bike racing over and over and over and over and over again, you naturally sort of build all these different kind of skills and abilities to participate in the sport.
Yeah.
What we do on the coaching side is try to take the information from you guys and say, okay, you know, our client's going to go and do a race in 4 weeks, right? They don't have a series of a 2-week race or a week long race to go and jump into to get ready for that one race, right? So
yeah.
We need to actually break down all the stuff that's going to happen and work on each ability independently, which is pretty cool, right? So when we look at an athlete having to do, like you said, 5-minute intervals in repetition, or all these little accelerations that they're going to have to do in their race that, you know, you wouldn't do if you were just going out and riding for fun. But what is really fascinating is, I think we see pretty clearly on our side, is that if we break down all these individual components, like being more efficient at transitioning, you know, body positions and cadence at the same time, teaching people how to use different energy systems, that they can show up on race day. And I mean, they're not going to race like somebody who's, you know, racing as a professional world tour rider, but they're executing some similarities, which is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the reason, again, that the most valuable asset we have as an organization, I keep saying this, is knowledge. It's a sport full of nuances and complexities, and you know, it's actually very difficult to teach all of that. But what we sort of saw with EF coaching is that I don't want to say no one was trying, but in a way, it didn't seem like there was really anyone out there that was really trying to convey how to really become a better bike rider, you know, how to become a better athlete, how to get fitter, how to whatever, you know, like look better, you know, in a suit or whatever. Okay, sure. There's plenty of coaches out there that were doing that, but to actually how to become a better bike rider, bike racer, bike rider, you know, not just like how to become a fitter person. No.
Yeah.
How to become a better bike rider, you know, and I think there's a distinction there. It's like, you know, one thing is getting fit and another thing is becoming a better bike rider. And of course they're related to each other, but becoming a bike rider, better bike rider, that's a real specific little niche there.
Well, I mean, there's a huge gap and people don't really think about it. They just get on their bike and they go and they pedal hard and they think pedaling harder and harder is the way forward. And they don't necessarily think about breaking down these different components and improving on them. And so when you come to a camp like ours this week, like, well, guess what? You got to go around corners.
Yeah.
You got to go uphill, downhill. You got to be able to do all these different things. And there's no hiding anything. You know, right away, it's like, oh boy, I can't keep up on the downhills and they're going slow.
Right.
Or I'm getting dropped on every uphill, or I'm struggling on the flats while everybody's nose breathing. You know, it's just so obvious right away who's struggling with what. And then we can work on those different things independently. But I think it's been a pretty interesting couple of years for us on the coaching side, kind of, you know, finding our way, not only with, you know, building out the company, but also, you know, learning how to work really closely with the guys on the team, how to get more information, how to stay up with all the science that's coming out, and how to collaborate. But it's pretty amazing, like to your point there, that nobody else was doing it. But if we look at the amount of people doing, let's call it bicycling or maybe indoor cycling, you riding a bike for exercise.
Right.
Right. Because I wouldn't call somebody doing Peloton cycling really, like, I don't think you can call that cycling. It's not really outdoor cycling where you're going around corners and stuff like that. To me, that's what cycling is.
Right.
I think riding an indoor bike is just pedaling an indoor bike. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a, you know, there's an old saying in cycling that, and this is it's encapsulating all these complexities, but, and people would never understand this when I would say this to them, because it makes no sense in the context of most other sports. As I would say, racing is the best training, right? Well, you know, you think about that in context of any other sport, you know, playing a game of football is not necessarily the best training for football because you're just getting beat to a pulp, right?
It's actually like counterproductive.
Yeah, exactly. Or like running a marathon is not necessarily your best training for the next marathon. Like, the, you know, most top marathon runners do like two a year, maybe three, right? But in cycling, the best training is going and doing a race for the next race, right? And so, okay, so wait, why is that? Why is that so in cycling and it isn't in the other sports? Well, it's because the level of complexity and the difference of all the energy systems and like understanding sort of like the feel and the movement of the peloton and, you know, getting those coordination and hand-eye coordination skills and balance skills really refined, you cannot do that in a simple format like a peloton bike, right? You actually have to be out on the road. You have to be going around corners fast. You have to understand that, you know, carrying your momentum, like when you're on a rolling road, that you know, if you just go steady and you kind of go steady on the downhill and steady on the uphill, you're actually going to go really slow. That actually the fastest way to go forward on a rolling road is to sprint up the hill and coast down the hill and carry your momentum into the bottom of it. You know, that going steady is actually completely counterproductive.
Well, what's funny is the people here at the camp were like, hey, I noticed you guys always pedal on the downhills.
No.
Right. So. To your point, like coasting, obviously you're maybe not applying the same pressure.
Yeah. Not coasting. Yeah. You're still turning the pedals.
So you're kind of exaggerating because, you know,
I am like, exaggerating. Yeah, no, it's true. Well, you know what? Actually you flush lactate faster.
If you keep pedaling.
If you pedal a little bit. Yeah. It's like, and we've seen this over and over again when we do, you know, VO2 max tests on guys, that if you just have them stop at the end of the test and you take their lactate for the 3 minutes after the test, that it decreases at a slower rate than if you just have them sit, you know, at 100 watts or 150 watts, it actually comes down much faster.
So in JV's mind, if you're still pedaling but doing 50% less power, you're coasting.
Yeah, that's what. Sorry, I was exaggerating the point a bit.
But what's interesting about, back again to your point about the resources not necessarily being there for people to learn the sport of cycling, If we go and we take a Peloton class, and guys, I'm not hating on Peloton here. It's just an example. But if you go and you take a class there, or I'm sure many other online platforms where you do spinning for exercise, the sit up, stand down, sprint 10 seconds, do this, do that. Now, you know, do some different exercises with your dumbbells while you're on your bike. Like, that is not teaching anybody the sport. That is just purely working on like one component. And I'm not even sure that fitness component translates to like riding the way we ride bikes on the road.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're becoming fitter. You're becoming a fitter, you know, healthier body by, you know, by doing that. You're not necessarily becoming a faster bike rider. I mean, it's just they're intertwined but still distinct.
So our mission stays aligned. We are going to teach as many people the sport of cycling as we possibly can. I think we're just about out of time, JV. I know you're super busy, and I appreciate it so much, you taking the time out of your day to come and do this podcast. It was really, really awesome. And again, I'll say it on air, massive thank you for extending this opportunity to do this company, not only to me, but to the entire bike industry, man. This is a really amazing journey that we're on, and I think we're going to make a huge impact in the whole world of bicycles.
Well, thanks for having me as a guest, and thanks for working so hard and getting it off the ground.